can speak and be with us, and just give us receptive hearts and help us just be willing to listen, to respond, Lord, to be challenged. In Jesus' name.
Thanks, Anne-Marie, and thank you for coming out this evening. This building reminds me of 46 years ago in Fernie Hill, before we had the church. We used to meet in Society Hall at the village, and in the centre of the village at the traffic lights, but they doubled the rent. And so while we were trying to build our own building, we then used the local community centre, just down from where the church currently is, and it was a wooden building, very much like this. So, brings back memories, and it's good to see that you've come out this evening, the brave people. Now, Anne-Marie told me I couldn't play a video, so I thought I'd try some other kind of technology, we'll see if it works.
I believe in a higher being, or a super... supernatural being. I'm not too sure if that is God or a particular God, or if we all share the same God, because I take views on board from a number of different religions.
No, I don't really believe in God. I don't necessarily believe in a higher power either. I don't know, my life functions quite well without the belief of that, so...
I believe that there is something there. I don't know exactly what, but there are things that can't be explained by normal human behaviour without a God. But whether it's God or Buddha or whoever you believe in, whatever you believe in is up to you, really.
Well, I believe in God. I just haven't found any churches that I agree with.
I do believe in God. I believe that He is our creator.
I cannot say that I believe in God, but also that I don't. I think I'm more of a scientific person. I need to see something to believe it, but I don't know. I don't believe in the church, let's say it that way. If I believe in God, yes or no, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't really believe in God. I think I'm more like a science person, like I'm more in the science than in God. I'm more like agnostic. Maybe there's something I don't really know, and finally I don't really care. It's like I live my life, and as long as I have a good life, it's okay. I'm happy like that.
I'm agnostic, so I'm not sure really if he exists or not, because while there's evidence for God, there's also evidence against. Maybe not evidence, so to speak, but theories, and both theories have equally good points. And that just, it leads me to a confusion.
I thought I would just show you that because it's kind of interesting, because we want to really be anchored in the real situation of proclaiming Jesus, because that's the kind of person who's going to have these kind of words. And I wonder if you noticed the number of people who said, well, I don't really care. I'm not really interested. My life functions. My life's okay. So it's not a big deal. They didn't ask any difficult questions, because you'll have worked out now that the person with the microphone said, do you believe in God? That's what they were addressing. But it's, you know, that's the kind of view that's around. Well, it doesn't really matter. It's not that important. No big deal. Life's fine for me. I'm not sure if that's because they're all younger people and life's going well for them. Sounded as if it was in a big city. I'm not quite sure. It might be over the pond, probably. So how does all this relate to our situation? You're looking at proclaiming Jesus, and tonight we're looking at tough questions, and I've suggested the title, Why Doesn't God? Now, this is the outline of your series, and which I obviously stole from 2 weeks ago. It's great having the slides up, as well as the words. That's really excellent. And of course, that's the series. If you've been here every night, you'll know that tonight is the tough questions bit. When Christian contacted me a while ago, he asked me to choose one difficult question that people might encounter when sharing their faith. But because I'm somebody who can't make up my mind about anything, I said I wasn't really sure about committing myself that far in advance, and I wasn't really sure about the benefit of only looking at one topic. So I made the proposal that we look at this topic, why doesn't God, and then I maybe add two or three endings. That was a great idea because it meant that until last week I could completely delay which endings I was going to use. But I can't do that any longer. Like everybody else on this series, it's absolutely wonderful to read this book. It is a brilliant book. I reckon it's the most challenging book I've read for a very, very long time. Now, I don't want that to put you off getting it. It's very easy to get. And if, like me, you don't want any more books in your bookshelf, it's easy to download. And it doesn't take a long time to read, but it's potentially life-changing. And it could change not just your life, but the life of somebody else you know well. I just want to highlight what I think was the most significant thing for me about this book. Rico Tice in chapter 2 says, here are three truths that have helped me motivate me over the years. The first one he says is the glory of Jesus. The Lord Jesus deserves glory and supremely we want him to be given it. So that motivates us to talk to people about him. The second one is the guarantee of the new creation. He says the new creation is a wonderful place we urgently want people to enjoy. So we want to tell them about it because we don't want them to miss out. And the third one he says is the grim reality of death and hell. He says hell is a terrible reality we desperately want people to avoid. If we don't think on anything else tonight, just think about these things. I found it incredibly challenging. No, I'm not going to duck the topic of difficult questions, but I do want to think about questions in general. I think it's useful to think about the kinds of questions that people ask. It avoids me getting on to the ones I have to address. I think there are a number of five types of questions. The first one I suggest is a personal question. That may be something that your friend or your colleague is really concerned about. Something about their experience of life or their concerns or their worries. The second one I'm going to suggest is a serious question. That's something that genuinely bothers them, but it may not be deeply personal to them. The third one I'm going to suggest is a popular person question. This is something that's a very commonly asked question about Christianity, but it's probably not a burning issue for them. And then there's what I describe as a smart or a trick question. Only a particular type of person asks this. It's usually designed to make you feel small, and the questioner usually isn't interested in the answer in the slightest. And then the distraction question. This is a very common type of question and often seems to be meant to be a distraction during the discussion. Now, I haven't got this from anybody else. This is just my own personal view, just so you don't think I'm putting it forward and not attributing where I got it from. It's just me to blame if it's nonsense. If we think about the woman at the well, it's maybe a bit presumptuous, but I'd like to suggest that we can identify some of these types of questions in the passage that Anne-Marie just read to us. She made many of statements, Jesus made many responses, but I just want to look at the questions here. Now, I've done this clever colour coding, but on this screen that's not going to work too well. Her first question I would classify as a personal question. Could be a distraction. After all, Jesus had just asked her for a drink of water, and she responds with this question. However, I think it was genuinely personal for her. How come you, a Jew, are asking me, a Samaritan woman, for a drink? We've all thought about this passage many times. It was a very big thing for this woman to be asked for a drink from Jesus. So she genuinely wanted the answer to this. The second one I'm going to suggest was a serious question. Sir, you don't even have a bucket to draw with, and this well is deep, so how are you going to get this living water? It was an obvious, serious question. How can you do it? This is also, in a sense, it's a serious question, But it was also, I suggest, a bit of a popular question. She says, are you a better man than our ancestor Jacob, who dug this well and drank from it, he and his sons and livestock, and passed it down to us? This is a bit of a focus on the difference between Jews and Samaritans. And this is, you know, we're really proud of our ancestor Jacob. You folks go on about Moses, but we like to focus on Jacob. And so in a sense, it was a kind of popular question. The last question, oh, so you're a prophet? Well, tell me this. Our ancestors worshipped God at this mountain, but you Jews insist that Jerusalem is the only place for worship, right? Oh, you, by the way, I should have attributed that these are from the Message. They're clearly not at the ESV. Many of you may think this question was serious or perhaps popular. The topic was certainly popular. But unlike many preachers I've listened to, I've always felt that this is a brilliant example of a distraction question. After all, he has just told her her marital situation. He's just pointed out clearly her moral problems. And so what does she do? She doesn't talk about that at all. It's as if he never mentioned it. It's straight on to, ah, well, you're a prophet. He must be a prophet to tell her things that nobody else could possibly know. But she doesn't ask him how it's going to work with her. It's switching the focus to a major theological, logical difference between Jews and Samaritans. Oh, that's a bit nasty. Well, let me just ask you about this one. Now, that's just John's interpretation. There's no guarantee that's the case. And clearly, she was impacted because when she went away and spoke to the people in the village, she said, come and tell me a man who told me everything I ever did. She didn't come and say, here's this Jew who's telling us we should worship in Jerusalem. Now, of course, we should be looking at Jesus' answers to the questions because that really is what matters. But that's your homework for this week. So, How should we answer these kind of questions? Well, we need to be very careful. While I suggest to you it's useful to try and think about what kind of question this is, where is it coming from, we need to not rush to judgment. It's very possible, especially if you're me, to misunderstand. So we need to be careful. So, however, I'm going to suggest if the question is a personal one, we need to be sensitive, extremely sensitive. We always need to be sensitive, but we need to be very sensitive and beware of appearing trite. If the question seems serious, and no matter how tough it is, we mustn't dodge it. It's very easy to dodge it, but we mustn't dodge it, and we'll come back to that. If it's a popular question about Christianity, then it's a good idea to have come to lots of services and done a wee bit of reading and generally have a good answer for the stock questions. If it seems pretty clear that they're just being a smart aleck and trying to give you a hard time, now that happens very often in a school playground or in a group situation or maybe in a pub, they're trying to make you look silly, then if you've got a quick wit, you might be able to respond to them with an alternative question if you can think of one, and that's often a good technique. But it's probably okay to give a general reply or maybe even treat it with the contempt it deserves and don't say anything. If the question is pure distraction, then do try to give a clear answer if you can, but maybe don't make it too detailed. If you feel the person's asking something, they're not really bothered about the answer you give, don't spend a lot of too much time and effort on it, and don't get too sidetracked into dealing with it. Now, this is great, because I've distracted you so long, I've almost got halfway through, and I've not tackled any of the difficult questions. You spotted that, of course, didn't you? But before we look at these difficult questions, I'm going to give you what I think are the answers. Anne-Marie joked earlier on, as I think only she can, that what was happening tonight was going to be that I had got it wrong and you were all just going to ask me difficult questions. And I told her that wouldn't be a problem because if she'd read my notes, which I sent her a week, my slides, you will find that the answer to every question, every difficult question, my answer to every difficult question is I really don't know. That's definitely my first response. It's honest. It's almost always true. And actually, I think if you say that, it's appreciated. We don't have to know the answers. And if you do know the answers to some of the questions I'm going to deal with tonight, I'll put my jacket on later and you can tell me at the back. But we must do that sensitively. And I think we should have a but. We should almost always have a but. And if we do, we have to be sensitive and humble about how we do that. I think this is a great response if it's a question you've never heard before, you really don't have a clue about it, but you do need to be genuine about getting back to them. That, I was well practiced with that as a lecturer for students who don't ask you, who ask you something you don't know the answer to. It's a winner. I'll check it out and I'll get back to you. But it's a disaster if you don't get back, because they'll remember. So you do need to get back. And if their question is a serious one, you might need to get help from somebody else. Go and ask somebody and then come back to them. And they'll accept that. If you really identify with their question, I think it's a good thing to talk about your personal experience. I'm not sure I know the answer to that. I do find it very difficult, but this is how I found it helpful. You're not claiming to have the answer, but you're explaining how you personally deal with the problem, how you've come to terms with it. If it's a distraction or a trick question, then sometimes it's a good idea to say, is that really your biggest concern? Is there not something else you're more worried about? That's quite a useful technique. And then, have you ever thought about, that's a really good technique. You know, they've got you up some alley you don't want to be in, and you don't really know the answer and you don't think it's going to be very productive, then it's a good idea to ask them a quick, yeah, have you thought about this? That's sometimes useful. Now, I think it's extremely important that we always remember something. You're probably already scared by my technique. Well, I've got to talk to the person, think about which of the five different types it is, and then think how I'm going to respond. No. We need to remember the words of Jesus to his disciples when he warned them they would be arrested and brought before officials and judges because of their faith in him. And in the message it says, and don't worry about what you will say or how you will say it. The right words will be there. The Spirit of your Father will supply the words. I know you could accuse me of taking it out of context, but I'm going to argue very strongly that although your friend or your colleague or their family member is not actually putting you on trial, I believe this promise of Jesus is just as true in that situation as it is in a court of law. And I would say to you, and I'm sure most of you will know this yourself, it chimes with my experience of talking to people. But wait a minute, remember, Jesus is not saying you're going to feel comfortable. Nobody in a court of law is going to feel comfortable. He's saying you will be given the right words, even at the time, though you might feel it's not the right words, we can trust the Holy Spirit. My notes say I'm halfway through at this point, but I think I'm even less than that, more than that, I should say. And where are the difficult questions, John? Well, what questions do people actually ask nowadays? The thing is, I think questions have changed. The most popular questions have changed in my lifetime. Things that people were more burdened about in the past, I think, have changed. And while some of the questions have been asked for millennia, I think there's a shift has occurred. And if you read some of the books I'll mention tonight, I think that's true. And here's a book which I think is very helpful. It's called What Kind of God by Michael Oates. And Oates goes on to say, most of the questions I get asked are about God himself. The issue is not so much God's existence as his character. Now, sadly, I don't feel I have as much recent experience, but this is an IVP book, and this is his view about it. His questions, the accusations he deals with, cover a range of topical criticisms of God. What kind of God doesn't make himself clearer? What kind of God is still relevant? What kind of God doesn't prevent suffering? What kind of God doesn't care about his creation? What kind of God allows violence in his name? What kind of God lets the church represent him? What kind of God allows only one way? What kind of God would limit my sexuality? What kind of God sends sincere people to hell? What kind of God would send his son to die? You probably already noticed they're phrased in a manner that which we might feel is aggressive and indeed blasphemous, but actually it's exactly the situation that people talk about today. Now, we're not going to deal with these questions, but I am going to suggest that it's a great book to read and study. So, what are we going to talk about? Why doesn't God stop suffering, abuse, disasters? Why doesn't God deliver for me? Why doesn't God reveal himself to us directly? And plenty of others. I'm really sorry if none of these are the ones you wanted me to address. There's lots of good books. I've recommended one already. Why doesn't God stop suffering? I trust you'll not be surprised that I've chosen this one. It's the most popular question I think people get asked when they try to proclaim Christ. It can take various forms. Why doesn't God stop suffering, disasters, wars, evil? Or why do these things even exist in the first place? It's an ancient question that was written down by philosophers hundreds of years before Christ and can be expressed in many forms. Ott summarises it in one of its more polite forms. If there is a good and powerful God, he would be both willing and able to stop suffering. Yet he hasn't, so a good and powerful God can't exist. As ever, the argument seems pretty compelling, the logic seems irrefutable, and it's one where you know already what my answer is. I have to be totally honest and say I don't know the answer to that. But I always go on to say there are plenty of things about God that I don't understand, but then he's God and I'm not. So it's not too surprising I don't understand them. Of course, I would always add a but and continue by saying that much of the suffering in our world is a direct result of how we humans behave. God didn't make us like robots, and sometimes people choose to do awful things. C.S. Lewis gives us a brilliant summary. He says it is men, not God, who have produced racks, whips, prisons, slavery, guns, bayonets and bombs. It is by human avarice or human stupidity, not by the churlishness of nature, that we have poverty and overwork, but there remains nonetheless much suffering which cannot be traced to ourselves. As you'd expect from Lewis, it's a brilliant, honest summary. But notice it's important to say that not all suffering can be traced to human beings. I don't know if you saw a survey in 2004. The BBC commissioned ICM to survey 10,000 people. And the results of the survey were very interesting. 52% of the respondents in Britain said that the existence of suffering made it hard for them to believe in God. Whereas in places like Indonesia and Nigeria, only 13% said that suffering did make it hard for them to believe in God. Isn't that quite fascinating? That actually it's in countries where there's affluence, a good health service, however we criticise it, and lots of money, lots and lots of things for us to do, lots of success and opportunity, that it's actually in our society that people say, suffering puts me off the concept of believing in a God. But people, I would suggest, who experience real grinding suffering every day don't seem to have that same problem. That's interesting. Why doesn't God stop suffering? Well, if you want to find out, read Lewis's book, The Problem of Pain. Ott's book highlights a number of things. God is not uncaring or callous. We need to be clear about that. He is not to blame for the suffering we experience in this world. That's a very complicated picture. And we need to be clear that one day God will end all suffering. He cares about it as much as we do. But the significant thing is that Christians, we know that God knows what suffering is like and can be with us in ours. And I believe this last point is where we introduce the incarnation, the life and death and resurrection of Jesus. And any answer we give to suffering must, in my view, always focus on a God who cares about suffering. Of course, I can't explain why God allows it, but I do know that it's something that he's with us in. That was a very popular question. and I'm sure you're not very happy with my response. If you know a better one, please see me later. Again, though, we mustn't be trite when we're talking to somebody in a situation like that. But although being a popular one, it's a serious one, and you probably felt my second question was a bit of a con. It was a continuation of the first. Initially, I was going to phrase it as, why doesn't God help me, mine? But I actually feel that deliver for me is better. It's a serious question, but it's also a very personal one. Someone who asks this has experienced or is currently in a great deal of pain. They may have lost a loved one or endured some other major life tragedy. In my experience, they're typically someone with a religious background or even someone who has professed faith in Christ at an earlier point in their life. They probably attended a church for a long time. Indeed, they may still attend church. And their view is, why haven't my hopes, plans worked out? Why am I lonely, sick, depressed, ignored? Why doesn't God answer my prayers? I can only draw the conclusion that he doesn't exist or he doesn't really care. I'd be surprised if you don't know at least one person who's given up on their Christian faith after experiencing disappointment after disappointment. Cruelty after cruelty, let down after let down, maybe even by church people. Like all deeply personal questions, that's a very tough one to answer. Here's another book, which is Why Did God Let That Happen by Christopher Ashe. It deals with many of the issues somebody like that may be asking. Why did God let that happen? I'm not suggesting it's the best book you can get, it's a brief one, but it is pretty tough, and I definitely don't suggest you rush out and get a copy and give it straight to somebody who you know is asking that kind of question. I think it's too tough for that, and one of the reasons it's too tough is because he addresses the very tough issue of, does God control everything? He says yes. And he goes on to explore the implications of this in every aspect of life, and boy, is it challenging. But summarising some response, he says, we need to remember that God is not a bigger, stronger, cleverer version of us. The basic problem in this question about why hasn't God delivered for me, and indeed all the other questions we're looking at tonight, which criticise or accuse God, is really our complete misunderstanding of God himself. Because God is utterly unlike us, completely different to us, beyond us in every possible way. The wording in the book is far more impressive than that. But that's a reasonable summary. We have to get a picture of who God is. And he says, it's so hard to grasp this, not just with our minds, but with our emotions. Yes, it is really hard. It's impossible to grasp. But if we don't get some appreciation of who God is, we'll never be able to trust him. And he goes on to say, I think very sensitively, if things are tough for you just now, this may be especially hard to swallow. If we're talking to somebody who's hurting, we need to be very sensitive to the Spirit's guidance if we are trying to guide them along this path of understanding God's greatness and sovereignty. And sadly, I think there are Christians who cause more damage by forcing a sometimes oversimplistic theological view down hurting people's throats. Perhaps the best approach in this situation is to talk sensitively about your personal struggles and how you cope with them. And if you don't have any personal struggles or never have had, then you'll need to listen especially carefully and preferably silently to people who do. Our third question could be serious and was certainly popular when I was a youngster, but it can often be a distraction. Why doesn't God reveal himself? Surely he could make his presence more obvious by appearing visibly or speaking audibly. Why doesn't he make himself known today? My school friends in the mid-60s, I know for some of you, you really don't know what that could represent, but they used to say to me at school, why didn't God choose to send Jesus today? If he appeared on TV, remember that was before colour TV, if he appeared on TV and did his miracles, everybody in the world would believe him. My response was, just wait a minute, most people who saw Jesus when he was actually here didn't believe. But they would say, ah, if people could see it on TV, it would be different, they would say. Or you might feel, why doesn't God speak to me? Why doesn't he reveal himself to me if I'm interested in finding it? Why did he not just turn up like you're sitting beside me and talk to me? Or why are there so many religions? If there really is only one true God, as you Christians believe, then why has he allowed all this confusion? Surely all the religions are just different ways to God to suit different cultures. And anyway, why are Christians so out of touch? Surely no intelligent person can base their ideas about God on an ancient book which is so clearly full of sexual and racial discrimination. Christians are just so weird and narrow-minded. They've always been. So this doesn't make any sense. Christians just get in the road of us knowing about God. God should just reveal himself. Why doesn't he do this? Why doesn't he do that? Well, actually, all the difficult questions we've considered tonight really boil down to a criticism of what God, of God, that says or implies we know better than him. And after all, in this day and age, we have our rights, we have our opportunities, and God really ought to deliver. It's not good enough if he doesn't. And anyway, we can give him some good advice, because we know what to do. We know better than anybody else. Well, most of us never actually verbalise that, but that's really the attitude. It's criticism of God. And we need to begin... The only way we can deal with that, I think, is to get to the only reliable revelation we have of God in the Bible. The Bible's full of references to God's ways and God's wisdom being so much higher than ours, and I'm sure you can reel off many of these. However, in this context, the verse that comes to my mind is Hebrews 11 and 6. And without faith, it is impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. Yes, this is tough, and it's probably not the answer we should give to a genuine seeker, but if we're going to understand God, we need to remember that he is God. If you read the Narnia books to your children, you'll remember what the animals said about Aslan, the Christ figure. He's not a tame lion. And the problem that we find often when we come to share our faith and proclaim Christ is that our friends want to fit God into their box. They want a God that they can understand, that they can control, and that meets their requirements. And this verse tells us very clearly that God has conditions. However, it's very important that we remember the other verse that says, those who seek me shall find me if they seek me with all their heart. So we have to see the two. God is desperately wanting to meet our friends, much more than they are to meet him. But we have to come to God by faith. There's a very short book with a title. This is my last book, sorry, and I'm really concluding in a moment or two. I did warn Anne-Marie that I do have a problem with any sermon that's less than 50 minutes. Lectures are, any talk is meant to be 50 minutes. She did ask me for the verse. I had to say I didn't have one. This is a lovely book. It's a very short book. Its title is Tricky by Michael Dormandy and Carol Lafferton. Its subtitle is The Hardest Questions to Ask About Christianity and Some Answers. You can see the list of questions. We've touched on some of them. It's a useful resource. Sorry, I didn't mean to put you off talking about our faith tonight. I hope you're not put off, and I hope you're not even more scared about the kind of questions you might ask. As I've already said, we need to always remember. We need to always remember, don't worry about what you'll say or how you'll say it. The right words will be there. The Spirit of your Father will supply the words. You see, proclaiming Jesus is God's principal method of revealing himself to people. So we just need to make ourselves available and he'll provide the words to speak and the power to make them effective. Now, I just want to finish with a personal story. In his book, Rico Tice talks about a situation at school and talks about his evangelism. About 10 years ago, I went to a school reunion organised by one of the girls at school. It's always girls that organise school reunions. And it was very interesting to meet these people and to see all these school heartthrobs from when I was young who were bald like me, and it was a lovely experience. But one of the situations that was very interesting is that there was a girl who had been at school, who'd gone off to America, and she'd come back and she brought a book that she'd written about her early life. This was down in Ayrshire, called Muirkirk Lass. And she gave it to me and she said, "John, you're in this book." So I read the book with some trepidation. It was quite fascinating, because it told me a picture of her life and her experience, which was quite the opposite of what I imagined. It turned out that her and I ended up being joint doxes of the school. She was in languages, I was in science. And I thought her life was together and she was just brilliant at everything. And I discovered in the book that she thought that I was clever and that my life was together, which totally wasn't true. But as I read the book, I discovered that when she went to university after leaving school, and I hadn't seen her in 50 years, that she'd gone to the Christian Union and God had spoken to her and she'd felt challenged about Christianity. And she writes in the book, "I remembered John Hannah's words, 'You will only get one chance to become a Christian.'" Heresy. I wouldn't say it now. Completely shocking. Ridiculous. But obviously God used it in that woman's life to bring her to faith, or to move her just a little bit along. So my encouragement to you tonight is, don't think about all the questions and all the answers. Just be honest, just be open, and the Holy Spirit will get you to say something, and it might not be theologically perfect, but it will be what that person needs to move them a little bit along the road.
Thank you, John.
I wonder if we could just take a few moments then just to respond and just think about what we've heard.